Well, with the days getting shorter and the nights getting quite a bit colder, as a matter of fact, it's clear that we're at a big transition point weather-wise, and that means a lot of activity in the natural world, including with our insects. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and great to have back Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. He heads up the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and as always, great to have you back, Phil.
Nice to be here.
Really appreciate it. You know, it's kind of an interesting year. I've heard you often say that no year is just like another. Sometimes that means a lot of undesirable insects. But this year, I think we're really lucky to have a whole lot of white-lined sphinx moths. And we've got some great photos up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. So I hope if you're listening and near a computer, you'll go to that. But Philip, describe those for us.
Well, the interesting thing is it's been about the last 6 weeks that I've been seeing the emails, both of the caterpillars and the adult moths. And people call them hummingbird moths.
Yeah.
It's really a family, but this is one particular species. And what's somewhat unique is they tend to fly during the day when most of them fly at night. And they're great photographic subjects because even if you're sneaking up with your camera and whatnot, they just ignore you, where, of course, hummingbirds would take off and have a little bit of pink in the hind wings, some white striping in the front where the name comes from. Food sources is purslane and other plants. So purslane is a weed. Caterpillars are a type of hornworm, come in a black form with yellow markings, also has a green form with black dots, and everything in between. So they're very variable. Still seeing a few of those larvae, but the ones that are out now will burrow in the ground to transform and pupate in the ground, won't emerge till next year. But I think this phenomena, I see about once every 6 or 7 years, and I don't know what fuels it, once it comes, and I know one of my colleagues who uses this as a pollinator for columbine, she's a genetic researcher, they catch somewhere between 8 to 10 every night at the Ellen Centennial Gardens. They're using this to get some genetic diversity in their populations, but that shows you how common, because sometimes you can sit there for a week and not see one. So,
and are they native to the state?
Yes, they are. There's two other species in this genus, one that was imported for weed control. That's really quite infrequent. We see up in the northwest part of the state. And the third one is not near as common. So more often than not, if you're seeing something, it's going to be the classic white-lined sphinx.
And what about attracting them? Is there any way?
I mean, anything that's in bloom right now, you know, so much like hummingbirds, verbena seems to work quite well. I've seen them, you know, working anything in the aster family, nothing would surprise me because, again, they're looking for nectar. So if it's in bloom, they're going to be drinking.
And again, overwintering?
In the ground as pupae. These are dark chestnutty brown, about 2.5 inches long. It looks kind of like a cigar. That's the normal form that they'll get through the winter in. But the adults will stay active as long as the weather allows. So, you know, if we continue with this nice weather, a couple weeks more wouldn't surprise me.
Well, it's sure fun. I mean, we see them practically every day at our home.
Well, and as I said, you file this one away because it might be a few years before you see the phenomenon again.
Mark in Rockton has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry. I love the show when you have Phil on. My usual fall nemesis are the spotted Asian beetles. I'm wondering if there's any new research on that. And then this year, I'm experiencing the box elder invasion of the century. I've never seen anything like it. I have a white house on the edge of the woods, on the edge of a pasture. I know that's ideal for the Asian beetles. Is there any way to prevent the box elders? Is this because they're are box elder trees right close to my house, or do they travel also, just like the beetles?
Well, they don't travel near as far, but they can come from a couple hundred yards away. What's interesting to me, so last year was a classic. In fact, in my 40 years of chasing critters, probably the worst box elder bug year I've seen, and there was two phenomena. They had an extra generation because of the longer growing season, and they always do well in very dry late summers because that prevents the fungus disease, which is their natural control, from being active. I will tell you that my perception this year is nothing's going on with box elder bug compared to last year. So I'm a little surprised. But if it was going to happen, it's September and early October on these sunny days. So, you do get localized populations. They're pulling the same game as the Asian lady beetle is looking for shelter. And you really have to draw the line before they get under the siding or you're not going to be able to get them. So, you know, there are soap sprays that kill contact. There are more residual sprays that are usually a pyrethroid of some sort that you can put on. But, you know, you, in a perfect world, you probably would have wanted on a week or two earlier than this. But if you still got activity, now it's the time to spray. So just about any of the outdoor sprays you'll get at the hardware store or the discount stores will either be permethrin, bifenthrin, cyfluthrin, lambda cyhalothrin. They all end in THRIN, and those are the kind of compounds that will give you the knockdown and also work when it's cold out, which is somewhat important. Now, Asian lady beetle has really, to me, been in quite decline compared to what I used to deal with 10 years ago. I do know of a couple localized populations in the southwest part of the state that are somewhat impressive, but overall, again, it doesn't hold a candle to what it was when it, we're talking the early 2000s when it was really going crazy. And, you know, that is an invasive. Same spray takes care of both. Typically what I see with Asian lady beetle, though, the trigger is usually a good hard freeze, and then the nice days get them moving, whereas box elder bug, it's just shorter day length, 1st of September, here they come type of thing. So
yeah, there you go.
So if you don't want to use a toxic spray like pyrethrin, or a synthetic pyrethroid, on the box elders, insecticidal soap is effective, and
yes.
I assume that doesn't work on the beetles.
No, it doesn't work as well because they're too thick skin for it to be very effective. And,
and that's a contact thing too, right?
Yes, it's not pure contact. And, you know, we know for in the case of box elders, it doesn't matter what color your house is. I think it's just sunny locations tend to attract them. With Asian lady beetle, it's a visual effect. And it's contrast between dark and in white. And so even on a sunny day, what you have is your overhangs and whatnot are shaded. And those are the dark bars that they're picking up on. And those stinkers can fly from a couple miles away. I mean, it really is quite amazing. And the more exposed your house is, the more attractive it is, unfortunately.
There you go. Thanks, Mark, for calling. Appreciate it. Glenn in Amherst. Hi, thank you for calling.
There you go. Thanks, Mark, for calling. Appreciate it. Glenn
and
Amherst.
Hello.
Glenn, hi. Thanks for calling.
You bet. Thanks for taking my call. And some of my questions about the Asian beetle has probably been answered because, you know, we've got probably the peak of the Asian beetle right now at our house where around 2000 you couldn't go outside and inhale because there were so many. This year there are a lot. They're everywhere. They get in your hair, but this, of course, it's not as thick as what they were 10 years ago. But, you know, for the spraying part, you know, I mean, it's almost impossible to spray for them if they're just out in the yard. I look in my yard, you know, and there's just millions of them.
Yeah, but don't worry about those. I mean, because if they go crawl under a rock somewhere, they're not going to bother you. The ones that pose the threat that are the ones that are trying to get in. And as I said, I haven't seen the trigger yet.
Sure.
And once the trigger goes, then you're going to see this big congregation of them just all coming onto the side of the house and all trying to sneak under any crack and crevice. And for that reason, and this is where the conflict comes. Typically, if you ask my advice, I would say for cluster flies, which is another fall invader in box elder bugs, it's the 1st of September. With Asian lady beetle, I watch the weather, but I usually say the first week of October would be the prime time to get something on because most of those products will give you 3 to 4 weeks worth of residual. And so then you can take care of things.
Yep.
And are you saying spray right on the siding?
Yeah, well, the spray has both a repellency, so they don't want to land on it, but also if they land, it will kill them. And, you know, the main difference, you can have this contract service. The pest control firms have formulations that hold up better. You know, they're formulated to last longer. They don't weather as fast. But the chemicals involved are the same, and you can chase those chemicals down. But the problem is if you have a two-story, you're going to probably have to get up on a ladder because if you're going to air for these things, you air high because they're trying attic vents, soffits, those kind of weaknesses, and then around window frames because these are the places they can squeeze in.
There you go. Thanks, Glenn, for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. And Bill in Lancaster, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I was outside my house a couple days ago and was amazed to see a praying mantis for the second time in my life. And it was eating box elder bugs, so maybe that.
Yes, that wouldn't surprise me. So, you know, the dynamic is that it's probably a Chinese mantid, although we do have European mantids. There's no native mantids in the state. And although you could bring them into the state and they would survive the summer, they overwinter as a egg case that we, it looks like a golf ball. It's kind of spongy. We call an oatheca, and those would freeze out. So you'd find them in warmer climates in Missouri and in Illinois, but not Wisconsin. But that has changed in the last 10 years, and we know that we've got breeding populations here now, and so the numbers keep increasing. And I'd say the southern third of the state in Door County. Door County is just tempered enough that we know we have breeding populations there. So I get a lot more inquiries, usually late summer. They're neat creatures, you know, 4 inches
really
long,
cool.
And you know, again, a great photographic subject, and they're predators. And so they eat all kinds of things. And unfortunately, they eat a honeybee once in a while or a butterfly, but... If there's lots of box elder bugs, they will continue to thrive. And so it is kind of fun. It's, as I said, I use this quote a lot on the show, but the governor moved us to Missouri 10 years ago. He just didn't tell us, because that's what it feels like to a native Wisconsin person putting up with this kind of critter.
And on my Facebook page there, we do have, I don't have it right up on my screen, but you can look on your screen, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You'll see a picture of a praying mantis. We also have some spiders, a caterpillar in Latvia. we'll get to that and talk about that as well as we move along here. But I want to go to Elsie in Prairie Farm next. Elsie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm having trouble with I suppose it could be called a worm, but it's probably somebody's larva. It's a long, it's about 2 or more inches, about 1.5 to 2 inches long, and it comes into my house. And I've found them all different rooms, not so many for the last 2 weeks or so, but you have to try to kill them, which isn't so easy, because they seem to have like a little steel armor or something, and
sure.
They're skinny, and they go in a straight path, and they're very determined to move along really fast, and they're soft underneath. When you turn them over, it looks like a bunch of legs, only it's probably just protrusions.
No, those are legs, and so that it's not a true insect. It's an animal that we call a millipede. So millipedes are very common in soil.
I've seen millipedes, and they were much larger and brown maybe or something.
Oh, but there's lots of different species. The giveaway is that what characterizes the millipede is two pairs of legs for every one of the body segments.
Okay.
Whereas,
I thought of them, but then I thought this doesn't look like them at all, but maybe it's the earlier version.
Well, no, there's different species.
There's different species of
so
millipedes.
So there is some variability, but the hard crunchiness about them would suggest. Now, you know, other things that invade, sow bugs invade, but it's kind of the same story. These are things that normally live in the soil, so they can't breed in your house. But many times they're out cruising around at night, and then when the sun comes up, they're looking for shelter, and that's what drives them underneath door sweeps and other
that's
places.
That's where they've been coming.
So one of the arguments here is to try to get a door sweep that is tight enough fitting that critters can't push through. Because indoors, there's no reason to spray. I mean, you might as well sweep them up, vacuum them, or the like, but you don't gain anything by spraying. Some people spray along the outside and foundation. That helps a little bit. But, you know, we've talked on the show before. I mean, I have seen these things coming in by the hundreds of thousands. And then when you spray, even if you kill 90%, the 10% that get past you will make you disappointed. So, as I said, I think it's more of structural adjustments. Most homes have a weakness where the siding meets the foundation. There is spacing that things can crawl up into and get in the house. And so using expanding foam and other similar items is well worth the effort. Because like so many of these fall invading creatures, if you solve the riddle of how they're getting in, you're done. Whereas if I come up with this chemical, you know, that's an annual application and the like. So as I said, sometimes it takes a little bit of, you know, down on your knees and looking around, but you know, any kind of opening that they can squeeze into, they will. So you try to seal that up. The other thing is it is worth going out at night sometimes with a flashlight, because it really is a different picture of what's active. And, you know, with millipedes, I've seen those things migrate from 100 yards away. And so, as I said, spraying along your foundation really doesn't in the long run solve that problem. So the good news is they're harmless, but boy, they can be quite a nuisance. And but as I said, look at closely. You might need a magnification glass of some sort, but two pairs of legs for every body segment. It's got to be a millipede. There's no other creature we've got that's like that.
Good luck, Elsie. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I am Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lots of great photographs of insects on moths and walking sticks, so all kinds of things here. Spiders on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. I hope you'll go to the page if you have a chance and take a look at some of these photos. you have a question for us, you can post it on the Facebook page, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org, or call us. Love to have you call. 1-800-642-1234. And we've got a Billy sent us a photo of a beautiful moth on their garage in Woodruff. It's pink and white. And
so pink is not a common color with moths.
No.
This one is called a rosy maple moth.
Rosy maple moth.
And it's in the wild silkworm family, so the big Cecropia moths and other things we have. This is one of the smaller species, but just a really neat critter. And
boy,
of course,
is
that
it
contrast
beautiful.
With the yellow. And you know, caterpillars really never get numerous enough to really cause us any concern. So to me, it's more of a trophy than anything anyone would worry about. So,
well, it is beautiful, that's for sure. Joe in Harper's Ferry, Iowa, has a question for you. Hi, Joe.
Hi. You know, Larry, you're going to Hawaii here soon, and there's a fellow on our little road here that goes out there each winter. And he's always made the point there are no bugs out there, and I assume he means there are actually no pests like we know them. Obviously, there must be insects. Could Phil talk about the difference between mid-oceanic and Wisconsin by chance in regards to what his statement was?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'd beg to differ. I've only been to Hawaii once. It depends if you're on a dry side of an island versus the tropical side, but they've got some centipedes that will absolutely terrorize you because they're about a foot and a half long.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's fascinating from two things, because so much of their plant community is not native, and a lot of their insect activity, they have relatively few mosquito species. That's one good thing they've done. They also have very interesting evolutionary things, and you can see this sometimes in some of the educational things they have on the island, where we think one species was the original founder, and because there was no other insects in that niche, it broke into dozens of species. Some of the wood borers, it's just fascinating to see how they have claimed some of these niches. But as I said, when you get into some of the wetter, warmer areas, cockroaches and all kinds of things one would expect. So on the dry side, you know, that's usually not as conducive for insect activity. So I can see where it would be less. But they had a lot of neat critters there. I was more than entertained when I was in Maui.
I have not been to Hawaii. So I'm really looking forward to this trip. It's going to be a lot of fun. And hopefully I'll have some insect photos to bring back.
Yeah, that and the birds. And I said, it's a pretty special place.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And I think we actually still have some open spots. So for people to join me and my wife Renee and daughter Emily. So thanks, Joe. Appreciate it very much. Teresa in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
A couple of nights ago, a very fairly large critter landed on our screen, and we got a good look at him. He was looked to be in the grasshopper family, very bright green, super skinny legs, mm-hmm. and with his wings folded back, they sort of formed a like the top of a triangle.
Sure.
And is that a leafhopper?
No. Leafhoppers are tiny little critters that jump.
Okay.
So we call the family... Yeah, I know the group you're from.
So
we call these things longhorn grasshoppers as a group, and they have very long, skinny antennae. They tend to be green. They include the katydids, the angle-wings, and at least two or three other species. So to call it a katydid would probably be as appropriate as anything. Many of them are tree species or bush species. Some of them are extremely noisy. The males of some species at night are just this very interesting, rattly sound. And you can hear one in one tree, and they call back and forth, and to the point that people will call in and want to do something about it. Now, you try to find a little green bug in a great big green tree, and it's going to be interesting. But, and seem to have a pretty good year. I mean, I've seen and hence had more requests to identify those than I would say in a normal year. Which, you know, Larry had brought up again, what's an interesting dynamic. So last year I set a record in the lab for specimens processed, and it made so much sense because we had an extra month of the growing season and I had all these southern migrants. This year, honestly, I wouldn't call it buggy compared to what I'm used to, and I will surpass last year's numbers. I mean, it just...
Is that right?
I don't know how to explain it, but lots of interesting things coming in, and of course that's what gets it. As typically happens... the older you get, the less you understand how the world works. So,
yeah, we've seen a few other odd species that we had, like beetles and things we'd never seen before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the wet spring had some dynamic to some of what's going on here. But as I said, I definitely, if you ask me, I would say this is averaged a little bit below average feeling to me as far as insect activity.
Yeah.
So
there we go. Thank you, Therese.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate the call. We got a Facebook comment from Jennifer who says she has the perfect organic solution for controlling box elder bug populations, the vacuum cleaner. When they gather on the sunny side of the house, her husband gets out the shop vac, and he just sucks them all up.
Good idea, but for any of the stuff, millipedes and the like, it's good to clean out the shop vac, because what you find is insects are so high in fat content, and so are millipedes. If you let this biomass sit there for a period of time, it will start to get quite odoriferous. And so it's good to kind of clean that stuff out. But, yeah, nothing wrong with physical. The other thing I love, my old colleague down at Iowa State used to talk about a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water. And I remember this very clearly years ago. We were doing the show, Larry. Somebody called up and they tried Cheer and it didn't work.
Didn't work.
Well, this is all why we recommend insecticidal soap that's sold at the hardware store. It is the right stuff. I don't know what is in some of the home remedy stuff, unfortunately. So it is good to buy the proper stuff to get control.
We had a photo up on Facebook from Raleigh who says, oh, worried about these hornets. And there's a close-up of these hornets. Stung at least 19 people to death in China, nearly 600 stung.
So the giant Asian hornet is like our bald-faced hornet, but three times bigger. I mean, it's just this huge creature. So it is a paper wasp is what it is. And it's been getting a lot of press because at least in one area of China, the numbers are unusually high. With any yellow jacket or paper wasp, if you disturb the nest, they're very defensive. And so a number of people have been stung. And because they're big and they have a lot of nasty venom, never been recorded in the United States. We do have a somewhat closely related European giant hornet established in the Northeast. I've never seen it in Wisconsin. It is a similar size. It has a little different color face to it, but doesn't seem to be as aggressive. But as I said, with all the press that's going on, so I've had a number of inquiries for cicada killers, which are the biggest wasp that we have here, and people are afraid. But cicada killers are not a paper wasp. They don't live in a colony. They're far less aggressive, so not a concern. But, yeah, I definitely, it's been surprising the last 2 to 3 weeks in particular with all that's going on in China, and it's getting a lot of coverage. In fact, I had seen a piece on Monday morning before I came into work on the NBC News about these giant Asian hornets, and they're as big as your thumb. You know, so they give you some references as far as the size. So you can imagine a typical yellow jacket, but that big with a normal yellow jacket disposition. It's not a nice creature to have to deal with.
And this close-up photo of one is...
Well, yeah, they're stunning animals.
Man,
they really are. And again, normally, as long as you don't bother the nest, they really don't pose a threat. But sometimes you don't know it's, you know, in a hollow log or... in a bush, and you bump in the bush, and that's when the problem comes. And so,
a couple of things about Hawaii. As we're talking about Hawaii a minute or two ago, listener Lynn said that when she was in Hawaii, she was amazed at how many chickens there were everywhere. There were chickens, and they seemed to be eating a lot of insects.
Yes, they would. They would take care of ticks and other things. They're very good at foraging on little critters that jump. Not so good for flying insects, but things crawling around, they're pretty good for.
And another on Hawaii from a Facebook comment from John, who says Hawaii has a huge problem with termites. They affect virtually every wood structure I lived on. He lived on Oahu for a couple of years and would see houses tented for termite fumigation all the time.
Yeah, and their problem there is not one species. It's multiple. They've got drywood termites. They've got subterranean termites. They've got Formosan termites. And so they're coming at you from every which direction. And in tropical climates, it is quite a challenge. And it's the one blessing we have here is that although we have a little bit of subterranean, it's pretty quiet compared to those types of climates.
Penny in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. The other day I was outside by my flowers and I took I thought, I just got to see a bumblebee or I got to see if there's any pollinators on this black-eyed Susan. And I looked closely, and I saw a mosquito, and it looked like it was putting its proboscis into the flower and doing just like a bee would do.
Okay, well,
is that possible?
It is. There's things that look like mosquitoes that are not, but male mosquitoes.
Really?
who do not feed on blood. The only way they get their energy source is to feed on the nectar of flowers. And so that is quite common. In fact, up in parts of Alaska and the like, there are mosquitoes that are the most important pollinators of some plants. Of course, they got lots of mosquitoes up there. So it could be. But again, a lot of creatures utilize nectar as a quick energy reserve. And so there's a lot of competition.
Yeah. No, I just thought that was really unusual.
Pretty cool.
And I had a question about, I saw a butterfly this summer, and I've been trying to be more of a butterfly watcher, but I'm new at it. So I tried to memorize the colors, and I ran home to my book, which I didn't have with me at the time, and it had to be some kind of a swallowtail, but the colors I thought I was looking at, I just didn't think any of the pictures had those colors. And how do you start to memorize butterflies?
We have about 150 species of butterflies, so it's not a daunting task if you take some time, although some of them you really have to get a very close look to separate. You know, one of the other things I guess I would suggest, it's just an exquisite site that Mike Reese put together called Wisconsin Butterflies. And what Mike does is, you know, he gives you the time that they're flying, the areas that they've been seeing in the state, and then people even report on a regular basis what they've been seeing flying. And that's a good kind of general reference because, you know, we had talked about last year. I mean, I had never seen a zebra swallowtail in my life in Wisconsin. And I received a couple pictures, and it was really a unique year, and that had a lot to do with that southerly airflow. In other years, you know, in overall, this was not a good butterfly year. You know, we're paying for that drought of the year before more than anything else. But that's kind of where I would start to see, because Mike does have, you know, three or four different shots of each butterfly, you know. So sometimes, you know, depending on the hind wing versus the forewing and whatnot, you'll get some different patterns. But yeah, you know, I saw quite a few giant swallowtails, quite a few tiger swallowtails this year. So they had reasonable years, but.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in too, by the way, 1-800-642-1234. Bob and Menasha, you are next. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Larry and Phil. Always an interesting program. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, I had a big maple tree cut down in my yard this summer, and it was rotten in the middle, and it had all this black earth-type stuff, and there were these huge white grubs in there. They were as big around as your pinky and probably as long. Can you tell me what those might be?
One of two things. My first guess is they're probably stag beetles, and those are the grubs, and you find them in punky wood. But somewhat closely related is a scarab beetle that we call Osmoderma, or it's also called the leather beetle. And honestly, the grubs are, in both species, very large and so similar that I have to get them under the microscope to separate them. So look up leather beetle and look up stag beetle, and you get a pretty good idea. It's got to be one of those two. But it's a classic white grub, but just five times the size of anything you've ever seen before.
Well, how big are the beetles?
About 2.5-3 inches long, more elongated with great big jaws in the case of the stag beetle. The leather beetle, it's more about the size of a 50-cent piece and a very dark brownish black. Apparently, the term leather beetle refers to, they have a distinctive odor that's supposed to smell like saddle leather to some people. They have an interesting odor. It's not a bad odor. It's just, you know.
Different.
But I'm not so sure if I'd say it smells like leather, but, you know, of course, we all have different opinions on that.
So are the beetles living in the trees and then they lay their eggs in there? Or how does that
no,
work?
They'll lay their eggs in the tree and let the grubs develop on their own. The beetles are most active at night, and if you're going to find them, typically they're attracted to lights at night. That's when you tend to see them. The leather beetle reminds you kind of, and it's in the same family as the June beetles. It's just one humendous large one. The stag beetles are just very distinctive. Again, the big thing is their big jaws on them. The males even more pronounced than the females. Don't do much with them. I wouldn't put my finger between the jaws, but they're really not dangerous. They look a heck of a lot scarier than they really are.
There you go. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Gene in Sun Prairie. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was looking at an article by UW entomologist R. Chris Williams about emerald ash borer treatment, and I know we don't have that in Dane County yet, but getting the idea that it can take up to 2 years to actually get that treatment into a larger tree. We've got a tree with a 70-inch diameter trunk that shades our house, so it's valuable to us. So what I want to start treating before ash borer is discovered within 15 miles?
Well, you know, Chris is doing the research, and so it basically, I guess, I'm very comfortable with his decisions on this. Yes, it is a little more difficult to move the chemical, but emerald ash borer doesn't kill the tree overnight. Typically, it's a 3 or 4 year process. This product is curative, so if a tree is infested, you can turn it around with a treatment. So all those things, you know, come into play with why Chris has used that as his advice as far as what to consider. And I think what we're balancing here is the cost of spreading, treating a tree. Now, the other part, I guess, is personal peace of mind, you know, and if somebody in Dane County, because there's so many counties around us that are infested and saying this tree is worth tens of thousands of dollars to me and my property, and plus I have sentimental value. If somebody were going to start to put chemical in, I can understand that. But really, the science would suggest you're still fine, but you got to keep your ears open. I mean, you don't want to ignore this and all of a sudden find that we're 2 years into an infestation in the county before you start treating. I don't think that would be a wise decision at all. But
right. We're signed up to get that information by email. So,
yeah.
Okay, so you don't really have to be proactive on it.
Not here yet. You know, it's as I said, every year, the last 2 years have been quite disappointing, the number of new county fines we find.
Right.
And the other thing is you find some of these fines have been festering for 4 or 5 years, but it isn't subtle. You know, again, if you're watching your tree and you start to see dieback, you start to react to it, whereas a lot of these trees, when you find it, the tree's already half gone, and there's this tremendous suckering on the bottom, all the classic symptoms, and you kind of think, how could somebody miss this? Well, many times these trees aren't in somebody's front yard. They're off in a fence row back somewhere where, you know, people weren't watching. But as I said, I think especially if you're cognizant of what's coming, and I guarantee you locally when it does, found in Dane County and in the Department of Ag's quarantine, this will be front line.
Right.
Newspaper.
Front page.
Front
page.
Get your hands on the product.
Now, what does it cost roughly? Do you know, Phil?
Well, it depends on the size of the tree. I mean, you can get by with $10, $15 for a smaller tree, but a large tree, you might be talking $60, $70, $80 worth of chemical on an annual basis.
Okay.
You know, so that does mount up.
Yeah.
And
I was thinking about 40-something on sale, and...
Yeah, you know, and they have ways of injecting trees with certain products that last for 3 or 4 years, so that's something else you can factor in sometimes as far as the cost. Now, that would have to be done professionally. There are, you know, treatments you can put on yourself. Chris has got some videos out on how to treat trees, and you just need a tape measure and a bucket of water, basically. You don't need any fancy equipment. The tape measure to tell you how much product to put on, and then you drench it in the trunk area, and the roots will uptake it, and it works systemically. So
there you go. Good luck, Gene. Thank you for calling. Bunny in Racine, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Oh, I'm so glad to have Phil Pelletieri on. I find insects so interesting. And one thing we did see this year that was in the sphinx moth family was the lined moth. But last year and the year prior to that, we had a sphinx moth that was a clear-winged sphinx moth. And I got some photos of it, and it was the strangest looking thing. It looked like it had a little tiny bottle brush on its end, you know, on its tail end. It was just the most unusual thing I've ever seen. Also, we had a praying mantis also a couple of days ago. It zipped right past me, and I, what is that? So I turned around and looked, and there it had landed right next to me. That thing must have been 8 inches long.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I've seen praying mantis before, but I never saw any at that stage.
Yeah, well, you get a good size female, and they are impressive. I mean, there's nothing I don't think lengthwise is big in the state, so it definitely holds the list there. But yeah, so the clear wing, there's two species of clear wing hawk moths that we get. The genus is Hemeris. One's the snowberry clear wing, and as the name implies, if you ever get one slowed down enough, they don't have scales on all the wings. There's a big big section that is scaleless. And of course, what makes a moth or a butterfly is that they're supposed to have scales all over. They're great bumblebee mimics. You know, many people who are not familiar them, they remind you of bumblebee in size and a little bit in the striping that you pick up, but they're not quite as black and yellow. They're more kind of a dark brownish yellow. The most common one, it breeds on honeysuckle, you know, which is a very common plant here. And again, I saw, I'd say, above average numbers of pictures and specimens of that one this midsummer. You don't see them quite this late in the season, but that's a fun one to see. And again, if you've never seen it before, it will throw you for a loop because you do not think it's a moth by any means.
There you go.
Not at first. Until you get it was like the blind moth in that it was very easy to approach.
Yeah.
And when you got up real close, you could see it's like a little window in its wing.
Yeah. That's a good way to describe it.
Thank you, Bunny. Thanks very much for calling. Jill in Kenosha is wondering if praying mantis and walking stick are the same creature. I've had a few praying mantis on my property this year. Very vibrant green. The other day I had a very large brown one on my screen. This one had green on one side and brown on the other, so I was confused as to what I was looking at.
Yeah, no, I think they are different species. Walking sticks tend to, all the forms we have in Wisconsin are not winged, first of all, and very slow moving. You know, their whole trick is to be camouflaged and look like a stick. Mantids, you know, the face is much different. This great big triangular face. Yeah. They're very visual creatures because they're predators. They have to go find, you know, things to eat. Whereas walking sticks are plant feeders, in particular the common ones we have in the state feed on oak. But they're long and skinny. I mean, I can see that. But, you know, the mantids have a much more swollen abdomen, you know, which is much more pronounced. And again, the wings would be a dead giveaway also.
At my daughter's school, a praying mantis showed up on the playground. It was kind of, kids loved it. It was a really good experience for them. Keith in Fox Point, hi.
I'm actually driving through Madison at the moment, and I have a question for Phil, and thank you for being there. I'm a member of Wild Ones, and also my home is certified by the National Wildlife Federation, so I'm familiar with a lot of bugs, but I have a kind of a bizarre question, and it's probably off topic. My mother is entombed in a mausoleum that's indoors, and I've been fighting with this particular mausoleum for several years, and finally I've sourced a place that sold ozone machines that they put into the mausoleum that seem to correct it for time. And there are forage flies every time my family members go there to pay their respects to my mother. I have a question. Is there anything else that this particular organization could be doing for their indoor mausoleums that the forage flies would not be attacking the guests as they come and pay respect to the deceased people which are entombed in the mausoleum?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a particular bad problem. I mean, it's not an uncommon problem by any means. At times, people will spray, but the problem is you can't get at the heart of the problem. And forage flies breed on organic matter, and I don't think I have to go in more detail where they're really breeding, unfortunately. And part of it, my personal opinion, has to do with design. Because, you know, I know in the case of coffins and whatnot, those are sealed as well, but at times those seals break. But within the individual chamber, if indeed it was, you need airflow, I understand that, but things were screened in a way so the flies couldn't get access, that would be the way to do it. But in most cases, we're retrofitting here, is that, you know, things are already done and they've already got access. And so there is no easy answer here. Sometimes they put in little dispensers that are giving off a little spray of pyrethrin, which is a natural insecticide. It's a fly knockdown is what it is. Just trying to keep the numbers down, but it as I said, this has been a problem from well before I was an entomologist, and I just have not seen any easy answers to it.
Are the ozone machines actually working? When I go there in the morning, let's say at 8 o'clock when the doors open, there's an obvious odor of ozone in the air, and it seems like there are a lot of deceased forage flies on different objects, but there still seems to be forage flies coming into the eyes and nose of the people when they do come in. They go to moisture, obviously, and it's a very awkward situation to be a person with them in your eyes, in your mouth, when you're paying respects to your family members.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, ozone probably is used more for odor reduction. You know, they looked at it as a way of treating bed bugs, and it had some successes. The problem, if you have it in contact where people are spending a lot of time, there's some health issues when people exposure to ozone. So by itself, I have never seen it developed as an insect treatment per se. It's like, even though it was investigated for bed bugs, they kind of backed off on it. It has worked somewhat in stored grain facilities where we have a closed system. So that may be what they're going, but you have to have certain ozone levels and you have to monitor that. And I just wonder if that ozone machine is generating enough to get that done. As I said, I've seen in experiments when you've got a closed grain system and everything under control, you can do it, but I've never heard of it in a situation like that. So as I said, I wonder if it's as much for just affecting the odor, and depending on the ozone level, it could become insecticidal, but I'm not so sure it is.
All right. Keith, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Net as we take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Samra in Oshkosh sent us a note on Facebook. It says, for the past three summers, wasps have set up under our deck in a spot that where we really physically can't reach unless we take out deck boards. What can we do now or over the winter to keep them from thinking our deck is a fine place for a home next summer? We'd prefer not to use toxic means.
Yeah, well, I think if you know what they're flying through, you know, if they're going through spacings in the board, then I think whether you screen it, there's a way of physically keeping them out. You know, caulking, sealing, screening, netting, something, you know, because everything starts from scratch the next year.
Yeah.
And if they can't get access to it now, you know, in parts of the state, the European paper wasp, that's a relatively new creature, has been somewhat problematic because it's notorious for making these little round paper nests behind things, you know, and so you get caught a lot in soffits and other places. We had a terracotta sundial, a little stinkers decided to set up housekeeping. I even had one try to do it behind my gas cap. But again, if you observe where they're coming and going from, I think you can make some physical adjustments and hopefully win the war.
We had an email from Kathy who found a piece of fruit from which fruit flies first emerged in late August. Since that time, I've eliminated all produce waste, found no nits, but have an ever-increasing supply of fruit flies. I have come to believe they reproduce by spontaneous generation, despite my schooling. Have you any other explanation?
Well, they can be a stinker.
Yeah.
But what you have to put together, it has to be moist. There has to be a source of organic matter. And really what's breeding them is the yeast associated with decay. So you think of the classic. I always tell people the bananas out on the kitchen table will attract adult fruit flies, but is not the source. That would have to be so decayed in the like to be the breeding population, you'd never even use it for banana bread. So recycling cans are a big problem. Rotting garden bulbs can be a big problem. When my kids were small, I told a story about how they bred on Kool-Aid that had kind of dried up in a paper cup. So you got sugar as a base, you got some moisture, and the yeast breaking the sugar down, you had everything the fruit fly needed. So just that scum. Same thing with, you know, rags that you've used to kids spill some orange juice and you wipe it up. If you don't rinse that rag out, it will get slimy enough that it will have the things that needs to get fruit flies. So if you've got this explosion in the house, they have found something. And even though it's driving you crazy, it's got to be indoors. There is no way you get those number of fruit flies unless that combination of organic matter, decay per se, and moisture. So dry stuff is not a problem. They need the stuff to have enough moisture to be able to sustain themselves, among other things. But as I said, I start looking at recycling cans, syrupy things, sugar-based, really, because the sugar is what's driving the yeast.
Steve in Mineral Point. Hi, thanks for calling. Oh, we lost ya. I'm sorry. Maybe try again, Steve. But you're completely gone from us. Mike in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I can report as of yesterday, the numerous monarchs at the south end of Juneau Park, at the east end of downtown Milwaukee. And another thing I was also noticing, there seems to be ever-present chalky white smaller butterflies that seem to also come in a yellow, various shades of yellow. And I was wondering if they're all the same thing.
No.
Same species.
Closely related. The white ones, the chalky white ones, are imported cabbage worm, which makes the little green worms on your broccoli. The yellow ones are, there's two or three different species. We sometimes call them sulfurs, and are associated with alfalfa, clovers, and the like. And both, they're both having good years. The monarch thing is interesting. I was out in the field the last couple of days, and I saw more monarchs yesterday than I have seen all summer long as they migrate through. And I also had a conversation with an old friend, Joe Jackson, who was the photographer with the State Journal. Ran into Joe and his family, and his daughter has volunteered at Obrick with the butterfly gardens, and said that there was a congregation of monarchs about 2 weeks ago in the gardens that we're talking a couple dozen. So even though it was not a good year for monarchs, we're still with this weather seeing things moving through. And so, as I said, I've seen more going on in the last week than I did combined all summer long with them. So hopefully things will continue to go well, and they'll get down to Mexico, and we'll get those populations knocked up again, because they have been
really down.
Very low.
Yep. Thanks, Mike. We had Glenn in Madison with a question for you. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. I was hiking on Isle Royal last month and encountered an extremely long worm, but it wasn't any bigger in diameter than a pencil lead, and it was very unusual.
How long?
18 inches, I'd say.
Okay, well, it's got to be a type of horsehair worm, would be my guess, which are not true insects. They are parasites, many cases of insects like grasshoppers. And, you know, so long and skinny, and then they kind of curl up. And, you know, what I was told as a student is it used to be, believe, a cricket had fallen in the bucket of water, a horsehair worm comes out from it. But people used to believe, again, kind of the spontaneous generation, you drop a horsehair into a bucket of water and it would turn into a live worm. You often see them after rain, where they're sitting and moving around. Again, I'm not aware of any species that are mammal predators or parasites. They're all insect in one form or another, particularly in the grasshopper cricket group. And it had to be a horsehair worm. I just don't know anything else that would fit that description.
There you go. Thanks, Glenn. And Cindy in Verona, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I've got a question about golden woolly bear caterpillars. I've noticed a number of them this year on my farm. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what they were. I'd never seen them before, but I've seen more of them than I have the normal colored woolly bears. I was wondering what the deal was.
Different species. So there is a yellow woolly bear, the band of woolly bear, I saw my first band of woolly bears a couple days ago, and mild winter, I'm going
you're
with
going
mild winter.
You
know, there's a reddish one, there's a blackish one, there's a banded one. They all belong into the tiger moth family. In most cases, the moths are kind of unimpressive as adults, but in the game for all these woolly bears is they spend the winter as full grown caterpillars. So when people think they're doing a favor by bringing them in, honestly, they often will not survive. What they are going to go do is crawl under a rock somewhere. And then next spring, when it starts to warm up, that's when they transform into the moth. And they need that cold shock in order to physiologically be set up to do with what they need to do. So you will see them. We can be in the middle of November. We get a nice 60-degree day, and there'll be woolly bears crawling around, and you kind of sit back. It makes no sense. If you found a good place to spend the winter, what the heck are you getting up and moving? Because the chance of finding a good place again is not near as good, I don't think. But it's a very common phenomenon. You can find woolly bears active anytime it's warm enough, and as I said, the transformation is next spring, not now.
And you're
wondering, I was wondering if the golden ones were new to our area, or have I just missed them before?
No, I think you missed them. Yellow. Okay. I'm guessing you had yellow woolly bear, and a lot of those are weed feeders, so you know they're not crop pests at all, and they have good years and bad years. I couldn't find a band of woolly bear last year for the life of me, and I thought it was the drought related. But as I said, I have found a handful of them in the last couple of days.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thanks.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And now on the woolly bears. I never can keep it straight. And they, in their predictions, or you're predicting based on how they look.
Right. So they're black in the ends and kind of a reddish middle. And the wider the reddish band, the milder the winter is what the tradition is.
Okay.
Now, again, what gets tricky is if you get the wrong species, you get a total black one. That's going to be the winter from hell. You get there is a total reddish brown one, but the banded one is the one that we've always used. And as I said, I do go look for it, and definitely the one I saw was probably about 70% red, and that's even milder than normal. So I was impressed and happy to see that. So
well, you know, when I have my weather guys on the last of the month, I'm going to bring this up.
Yes.
And, well, the other see thing, what they have to say.
You know, I've always told people is, you know, if you say it's a mild winter, they're happy. If you're wrong, they forget. On the other hand, if you start out by telling them it's going to be a cold winter, everybody hates you for the rest of the winter. So I tend to go on the mild side one way or another. So
there you go. Phil Pelletieri, University of Wisconsin Extension entomologist, our guest. Have a question for him? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. And we have so many great photos. I hope you'll go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and take a look at all the photos that are there. Click like while you're there as well. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back with Phil right after this look at the news. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are taking a look today at the insects of the state and some from out of the state, from out of the country, as a matter of fact, with our guest Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, always a lot of fun when he comes by. And Phil, there was a very interesting story recently about a new type of tick that traveled to Wisconsin in the nose of a researcher.
Yes, so the tick was apparently in the genus Amblyomma, which is that same tick that we talked about a couple months ago that we're seeing a little activity up here. We have the Lone Star tick that we're starting to deal with. This is the one that causes the meat allergies and all this other crazy stuff. And so, you know, apparently there's some suspicion here that this may be an undescribed species that is primarily picking on chimpanzees and other monkeys. And the researcher thought, and it appears to be its way it operates is to migrate into the nose, which, again, would be very hard to detect in its going out through. Now, the specimen was not in good enough shape to do anything with. This is where DNA technology can tell us stuff, so we can get some specimens. But, of course, they talked about the difficulty of capturing a chimp, checking its nose and whatnot. So there's some interesting dilemmas here. But the concept of, you know, how these things can be transported and, you know, ticks do vector some interesting diseases. You know, we didn't talk about Lyme disease and all that other stuff we have to deal with a different species of tick. But just some intriguing stuff. So just a little bit I know of it, as I said, I'm familiar with the genus, but this may be a new species. We're not quite sure, but it's from Africa. And could it come? You know, I have seen this before in my career of, you know, there was a lizard left on a zoo front stoop in Racine, and they sent me some ticks from the lizard, and you went, oh my. I mean, these, again, were African species, and the biggest concern is the public health aspect of it is are we bringing in organisms that could be transmitting diseases that would be concerned both to animals and people? So,
wow, there you go. Joe in Wausau has a question for you. Joe, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello, I have a yellow jacket problem. Last year, I was lucky to get an ice cream pail of grapes from three grapevines, so I started trapping them this spring in April. I was using chemical traps, and then all of a sudden they lost their effectiveness once the grapes started getting ripe, and I switched to apple juice containing traps. So I wondered how far they fly. Because I've been killing them all summer, and I've still got them all over my grapes. And I wondered how far they fly and where they nest. I know I had one nest in my compost pile, and they stung me. That's how I discovered them. Mm-hmm. But it just seems I heard something on the news that the ag department said there aren't as many this year. Boy, that doesn't apply to me. I've got as many or more as I had last year.
Okay. I mean, my take on it again, and it's just I don't think they're very – I've seen them far worse. And usually what I judge on what's a bad year is when they start to scavenge, when they start to steal food or compete with you. In a bad year, it's the 1st of August. This year, it was the middle of September. But as far as flight patterns, 100 yards or more, there are both ground nesting and above ground species that you could be dealing with. And they're after those high sugar in the grapes. And the problem with yellow jackets is, much like honeybees, they not as sophisticated, but they can communicate back to other hive members when they find a food source. And this is a dependable food source, unfortunately. The traps, to be honest, I don't think help as much as you might think, because all you're doing is taking sterile females out of the population. You're not getting at the heart of it, which is the queen that continues to generate new daughters. So that is somewhat problematic. So now it's a point of competition. Is you have to find something that's more attractive than your grapes. And it's not easily done. In fact, you know, a lot of research has went into this trying to find. I will tell you, I know people use Mountain Dew for some reason and find that that's quite effective. So you might want to play around with some soapy water baits with Mountain Dew to see if that goes. Or you can even start playing around with your own concoctions. It may even be some of the damaged grapes that you have are worth kind of masticating and mushing up and add some water to get that fermenting and put that in your traps, but keep the traps away from the grapes.
Yeah.
You don't want to put it in because then you're drawing stuff in and just see. The concept of the traps that is you're taking workers out of the population, you're weakening the colony, and they will need less scavenging because there's less mouths to feed. But all in all, late summer, I expect yellow jackets. I mean, that's just the norm. Is once you get into September, same thing with apples, you know, fallen apples. See, sanitation, you keep the unneeded stuff out of there because it will just attract them if you don't. But if you can't find the nests, that really would be what I would suggest to people is try to hunt down the nest, and it is not easy to do.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe, for calling. Appreciate your call. We said we have in our neighborhood, someone had a pear tree, and there must be 100 pears on the ground fermenting a little bit, and man, I'm telling you,
and as long as they're doing that, it's not a problem. Now, if you try to pick up the pear, you got a problem. I mean, as I said, you know, historically, the one that's given us the biggest problem is this German yellow jacket, which has been in the state since the 70s. That's what people often refer to as the picnic bee. Because it shows up when you're trying to eat outdoors. But that's the one that I'm just not seeing those kind of populations in the last few years as compared to what, you know, because think about farmers markets in Madison. I mean, you could not go to farmers market and not just have all kinds of problems on the bakery goods and whatnot. And, you know, there's a few out there, but not holding a candle. And I know my colleague Bob Jean, you know, when his students were working with it, they had found similar things. In fact, Bob, I think, had speculated there might be some diseases that are knocking that European species down. But, So you can have localized problems, but overall, the other thing I judge it on is emergency rooms, you know, the number of stings they've gotten. And I think you ask any emergency rooms, it's way down.
Thanks again, Joe. Linda in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. My mother, who is over 90 years old, has pantry moss, and I've tried all kinds of things like the pantry pest trap.
Yeah, you only catch males, so that doesn't work.
Oh, okay, and then I sprayed for the larvae, and it did not seem to help.
Okay, so it's real simple to say, but not so easy to do.
Okay.
It's like a fire. The fire is in a food product. You have to find the food source. So wherever the larvae were, you were close. Anything that's dried plant material, so cereals, nut meats, dried raisins, but you can also find them in spices, potpourri. I had a conversation with a woman a week ago that she found it in a Christmas Santa that was a bean bag, and it was all the little beans inside there that the little stinkers have gotten to.
Oh.
So what you do is you throw out what you know is infested. I don't like the idea of spraying because if you don't throw the bad box of Bisquick out, you still got bugs, and you can't spray the food. So I don't find spraying gets you very far. You got to be a good detective, and this is where it can get somewhat frustrating. But if you're seeing 20 moths a day, we're talking a box, a bag. We're talking substantial stuff. And
yes,
you know,
that's what I was seeing. And I know, I think that they were where the larvae was, I think, in between her cupboards. I think that's where the larvae were hatching. So I sprayed down there, and of course that didn't help.
The phenomena is when the caterpillars are feeding on the food, they're happy. They leave a lot of webbing, and it's usually very apparent when you open the packaging. But when they want to transform into moths, they will migrate away from the food source and crawl into the cracks and crevices or in a napkin or all these strange places to spin their cocoons down. So as I said, you're getting close to the source, but they have to eat something. So you see big larvae, those are ones that have moved away from the food and are getting ready to spin their cocoons. But, you know, if it's high up in the cupboards, it's something way up.
Yeah.
The biggest problem is you usually have a box of something that, you know, it's a cupboard full of dishware. I don't have any food in there type of thing. Or, you know, my own personal story is it started with birdseed, and it's notorious where they have the stuff in pet food. They got out of the garage. They got into our cupboards. We had to throw some noodles and rice out. And then we'd see one moth a week, and my wife would just say, "What? You're a really good entomologist, aren't you?" You know, and it took me months. It was driving me crazy, and I was looking and, you know, everything I could think of. And what it traced back to was a True Value hardware store bag that I would have told you there were screws in it. It was sitting on the shelf down in the basement next to the tools and stuff. It was a bunch of vegetable seeds my father-in-law had given me, you know. And until I opened that bag, and then once I saw the webbing, it was, you know, finally. But that's how frustrating it can be. But worry about Christmas wreaths made out of plant products. You know, as I said, potpourri. When somebody says, "I see most of the moths in the bathroom," it's got to be something like potpourri. I mean, you just don't normally have food sources in something like that. But it can be a stinker, because if it's in a box somewhere, put well away, especially where the food products are not normally found, as I said, until you do the detective work and uncover it, you're not going to win the war.
You know, years back when in my single days, when I rented a house with another fellow who had a dog, we found the source was the dried dog food, a bag of that.
Yeah. And the one that drives people crazy, and I had this conversation with somebody this week. If you have trouble with mice and the mice are stealing your pet food and stashing it in your walls,
yeah,
look out, because great for Indian meal moths, they can breed and the stuff isn't available. And so aside from not liking mice in the house, this is a secondary complication that I have seen more than once in my career.
Melvin in Chippewa County. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yes, hi, and thank you. Please discuss crickets as to their lifespan, and fairly specifically what they eat. And if the weather doesn't kill them, assuming they have a certain lifespan.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, there's numerous species. And what's interesting, mm-hmm. All plant feeders of one sort or another are decaying vegetable matter, but generally plants. And although most crickets mature in the late summer, we have some species that spend the winter as partially grown. And so we have spring crickets and fall crickets might be a way, and they're different kinds of crickets. Seems to be a halfway reasonable year for crickets is just mm-hmm. my take on it. And then there's tree crickets, and, you know, so there's even different groups. The tree crickets tend to be a light yellowish, whitish green, whereas the classic cricket is that kind of dark brown to black. And, and if you're good enough, there are ways you can differentiate the sounds of the different species. In fact, if you know the species, there's a couple of them that you can even correlate the outside air temperature, because they chirp more when it's warm and chirp less. And if you know the formula, you can, you know, so there's some fun things you can pick up on the internet, but you got to make sure you got the right species or it isn't going to work. And then you get the darn tree crickets, and it's not a chirp, chirp, chirp. It's just a constant shrill. And so those ones don't work so well. But
So they consume decaying plant matter rather?
Well, not fully decayed, but stuff, you know, we'd call detritus or whatnot. Mm-hmm. I would think they are capable. But, you know, normally when people are raising crickets, I mean, they're using oatmeal and other things to kind of feed them, to give you some kind of an idea. So it's kind of a dried plant material that they're getting into.
So they will live about how long if they don't freeze then?
Well, you figure from the time the egg's laid until we get the adults, we're talking 3 months is very reasonable. There may be some species that got more than a year. I'm just not that familiar with the group. That would not totally surprise me. Most of them, you know, you make the argument of the spring crickets, if they're basically born in August and then they mature next May, then you're talking 10 months.
Yeah.
But about 4 or 5 of those months, they're totally dormant. You know, they weren't active, and that's what a lot of these creatures do, is they just go in kind of the suspended animation to get the winter, and then when things warm up, they continue on. But said it is interesting. You can hear adult chirping crickets in the spring, and that is different than the adult chirping crickets that you see in the fall.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Melvin.
Over the winter and froze or something like that.
Yeah, well, you know, and then, of course, the tradition of bringing, you know, the crickets in the house, I know it's an Asian tradition, and you can keep them chirping into December and January if you get... The other thing about crickets is, you know, they're used quite extensively for feeding lizards and other things, so you can pick them up in the pet shops. So there are people that raise crickets year-round.
Thank you very much for calling, Melvin. Appreciate your call. I want to give Bill in Iron River a chance to join us. Bill, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, guys. Hey, I got, this is kind of a ugly thing that it's for wood ticks again. I was the other day I was pulling some wood ticks off my dog, you know, looking for them, you know.
Yep.
And I found a big, what would normally be a big fat one, you know,
mm-hmm.
but it was real small.
Yes.
And on the back of the wood tick, there was another
So because of the time of the year and the way they're behaving, those aren't wood ticks, those are deer ticks.
Really?
Now, deer ticks are quite active in the late summer and fall until the snow comes. The males do not feed, and what you were witnessing is the mating of that large female and the male. And for that particular species, they mate on the host. You know, this is where you got to be a little more concerned because the deer ticks do transmit diseases. And as I said, so that little tiny one was a full-grown adult male. They do not feed. In fact, their mouth is basically made for sperm transfer. It's just a very strange way of mating, but that's the way they work it. And then these females, as I said, so they have to meet up on a host. They don't meet up out in the woods like true wood ticks, honestly made off host. But this time of the year, it's quite easy. As I said, wood ticks, what we normally call wood ticks, the American dog tick, is more of a spring and early summer creature, whereas the deer tick, it's any time there's no snow on the ground.
I did not know that. That's something that hasn't come up in our conversation before, I don't think.
Well, you know, they look like different species, the males and females. I mean, they're really quite intriguing looking creatures. And so, you know, when somebody finds a male on them, the good news is they can't transmit disease. But if you're in areas where males, you probably are areas where they're females, and you have to keep your guard up.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Bill. Interesting call. Randy in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
I've seen hummingbirds all summer long.
Yep.
And about 3 weeks ago, I had a number of different native bees coming on my hummingbird feeders. So I put some of the syrup down on the deck to dry the bees down. And within a day or two, some honeybees showed up. And I had no idea what I was getting myself in for, but I've spent the last 3 weeks doing nothing but making syrup and feeding honeybees.
They're probably pretty happy with you.
6 gallons a day.
How much are you going through?
6 gallons of bedding a day.
6 gallons?
I've probably got at least 4 different wild hives. And I've talked to a beekeeper up here and told them about it. And because of the variety of colorations within these bees, he says they're probably all feral. So there's nobody has hives around my place that I can find. So.
Sure. Well, you know, and it's interesting as we've had all the problems with honeybees, but, you know, back 10 years ago, between the mites and everything else, I rarely would get calls about swarms. And we really felt that there was very few feral colonies out there anymore. But that has changed because I get a lot more swarm calls now. And so honeybees are found in hollow trees out in the woods again. And I think, you know, because of selection pressure, we now have bees that are somewhat resistant to the mites and some of the other problems that are out there. And so that probably is one of the phenomena you're going through is that, and of course, by providing them, you know, because beekeepers will supplement their bee diets in the late summer and winter to try to strengthen the bees up. And so, you know, if the bees are getting more food stores, their chances of surviving the winter are better. Now, this past year, we lost about 30%, 35% of our bees in Wisconsin to winter mortality, which honestly is normal. I mean, that's what I'm used to 30, 40 years ago. It was a pretty bad winter. You know, you have a mild winter. What the dichotomy was is the year before, we only had about a 10 to 15% loss, but it was extremely mild winter. So that plays into it. But you're more than kind to provide them with that supplemental food source. And,
good for you, Randy.
You probably will tend to see activity of feral colonies in your area for years to come. Because as I said, if they're that successful, that's a good sign.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your ability to keep at it and keep feeding those. That's a lot of
bit of money. Yes.
Thanks again. Don in Partyville. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I've got a quick question about yellow jackets, too. I've got them living up in the soffit in my garage.
Mm-hmm.
Am I, would I be better off to let them freeze out before I caulk the hole shut where they're getting in, or should I exterminate them first?
No, it depends on how busy you are, but if you don't have to get it done right now, what happens is they starve to death. It really isn't freezing, but as food supplies come, the way they get through the winter, the new queens have already been produced, the males are produced, they're already fertilized, and they have to start everything from scratch next year. But the yellow jackets will stay active. Normally you'd think about the middle of October, but it's been unusually warm. So I'd say the 1st of November, and the problem is if you caulk the hole beforehand, they'll probably find another way out and they probably will be a little agitated. And so I find usually it's best because now you've got a window from the 1st of November until the middle of June next year to plug that hole, and they don't reutilize the nest. But sometimes you will find another queen finds that as a good area to start housekeeping. But there definitely is no allegiance to come back to that same site.
Listener Colleen has a suggestion for getting rid of fruit flies. She puts some apple cider vinegar in a bowl with a few drops of dishwash soap. And the flies come in, are attracted to that, and die. And only took her a couple of days to get rid of all of her fruit flies that she had around.
So it's a good way to take care of adults that are present in your environment, but if they're still a breeding site, they just keep coming. So, these traps are a way of kind of, but what I fear is if there is a breeding site, this gives you a false sense that you're controlling them and all you're doing is pulling a few adults out of the population, but you worry about females laying another batch of eggs and then we're back off and running again. So as I said, there always is, if you bring in a bunch of bad tomatoes that are infested with fruit flies, you might have a couple days of activity. But once the food source is removed, they should be gone. If they're not gone, there is another food source in the house.
There's another food source.
Later on in the season, I start worrying about rotting squashes and pumpkins. That's a great, great place for fruit flies to set up. And so you can see them well into December.
All right. One more picture. We got to do one. Can you identify this photo on my Facebook page? Again, that's the Larry Mueller Show. I hope you can go to it if you haven't had a chance to see the beautiful shots we've got of insects. What's this one, Phil?
So this is a dog day cicada. And if you look carefully, there's a brown skin. The adult has now molted out, and the wings have not fully dried yet. The pigment colors haven't darkened, so it's kind of this light yellowish, light limey green. Dog day cicadas had a heck of a year. The numbers I saw coming in pictures, and from middle of July all the way well into September, I was seeing stuff being active. And so now our dog day cicadas are on a 3-year cycle, but they're some out every year. We had no 17-year cicadas in the state this year. It'll be 2024 before we see that. But the population out in the Washington, D.C. area was out and emerged this spring, and so that's why it was so much in the press that they talked about.
Phil, always a pleasure. Look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
Sounds good.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Great to have him along, and he will be back. Tomorrow, contractor John Freiberger is here to tell us how to make our homes more comfortable this winter while also saving some money. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.